Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you all coming very early today on the last day of the conference. And today we're going to be discussing PrEP in the Windy City, Chicago, keeping PrEP's promises, a Windy City approach to a new HIV prevention paradigm. I'm Tarek Mikari. I'm the medical director at the health department at the City of New York. And in case you're wondering why New York medical director is presenting a Chicago PrEP session, the reason is I just moved to my new role there 6 months ago. So I was part of this great group in launching PrEP in Chicago. We have great speakers today from all different backgrounds, and it's a very team effort where we launched PrEP in 2014 in Chicago. So I'm going to start with Jim Pickett. He is the Director of Prevention, Advocacy, and Gay Men's Health at the AIDS Foundation at Chicago, where he has worked there for 11 years. He heavily focuses on research advocacy around new HIV prevention technologies, and which includes all the PrEP initiatives, and chair the global network IRMA, the International Rectal Microbicide Advocates. PODD magazine has referred him to him as a soldier, instrumental in fighting for much-needed new prevention methods, undeterred by subjects many would prefer to ignore. And I have to say, he is a really true soldier. So, welcome, Jim.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Good morning. And I also extend my thanks for showing up early and on the last day of the conference. So we're going to get right to it. I have no relationships to report. I'm going to just start with just a really quick PrEP recap to make sure we're all on the same page of what PrEP is. I'm going to spend most of my time talking about the Chicago PrEP Working Group, which Tarek was instrumental in forming and all these members are a part of, and our three-pronged approach to kind of rolling out PrEP in Chicago, Centers of PrEP Excellence, which is something that's evolving as we go, a citywide PrEP social marketing campaign, and our trainings. And then I'm going to briefly talk about lessons learned and next steps. And I should say, we're going to keep our remarks relatively short, under 15 minutes or under, so we do have time to chat. So try to hang out with us for the chat part. So just so we're all on the same page, PrEP is taking an ARV drug called Truvada every day. It's more than a pill. It's a program, so it includes screening for HIV and STIs, treatment of STIs as needed, other medical monitoring, counseling, et cetera. Truvada is the only drug approved by the FDA for PrEP in July 2012, although there'll be new forms down the road in years to come. You need 5 to 7 days for protection rectally and about 3 weeks for vaginal, so that's how many doses you need before you have adequate protection in place. We don't see this as a lifetime intervention, but seasonal for periods of time. It is paid for, but there's a lot of barriers around costs. We'll talk about that. And the CDC released clinical guidelines last year. It's a central component of the newly updated National HIV/AIDS Strategy. It's part of the WHO guidance that just came out. And if people are paying attention, the International Association of Physicians in AIDS Care just released their guidelines on prevention and treatment and gave PrEP a very high rating, their highest rating, an A1 rating. And that just came out, I think, yesterday. So barriers to PrEP access. So there's awareness and education barriers, and those exist in a number of places. So in our vulnerable communities, the communities who most need access to PrEP, there is no or low demand at this point. And we can't have demand if they're not informed. We can't have demand if they're misinformed or if they're slut-shamed for choosing this intervention. We still see some of the slut-shaming. I think some of that has slipped down a bit, but there's still a lot of misinformation or no information at all. We need to do work with our HIV workforce, so that's people working in prevention, care, and housing. They're critical to implementation and to helping get the information out in our communities, and we're working on that. Also, there are awareness education issues with clinical providers. So, again, they face the same sort of issues. If they don't know about PrEP, they can't provide it. If they have judgment about it or they stigmatize it, they're not going to provide it. If they're misinformed, they're not going to provide it well. So big issues there. Significant issues around access in terms of cost. And it's not just drug cost. Drug is very expensive, but there are service costs and lab costs as well. We're seeing folks, you know, a lot of people are getting insurance in states like ours. We've expanded Medicaid. We've embraced the ACA. Many more people are getting health insurance, but it's not just getting it. It's how to use it. So health insurance literacy is a big issue, and people need support in how to use their health insurance. It is very confusing with varying amounts of premiums and deductibles and cost sharing. We get questions all the time. I have this plan, how will it cover PrEP? The devil's in the details. Or is Blue Cross Blue Shield good for PrEP? Well, it depends on your plan. And there's hundreds and hundreds of plans and so many various factors that come into play. So people really need a lot of support, especially in the beginning, and particularly for young people who are our main target for PrEP, who are not, you know, coming forward in significant numbers. They're also, if they're newly insured, they haven't used insurance on their own before, and it's really confusing. So onward to the Chicago PrEP Working Group. As Tarek mentioned, we formed this in about a year and a half ago. It's made up of researchers in Chicago, medical providers, advocates, a variety of organizations. Our health departments, our state, county, and city health departments are represented, and people who work in HIV planning. In Chicago, we have a coordinated HIV planning body that coordinates the delivery or, you know, how we allocate resources for prevention, treatment, and housing. It's the only one in the country that has that coordinated approach at the moment. So we have folks from that realm as well engaged. Right now, we have over 130 people involved in the working group. I show 120 on there, but the number keeps going up since I finalize these slides. So it's convened by the AIDS Foundation and Chicago Department of Public Health, and our main goal is to improve awareness of and access to PrEP in Chicago for the communities who most need it. We meet every few months, so we don't have a lot of in-person meetings. 4 or 5 a year is what we've been averaging, but we also connect with people on something called Basecamp. It's an online project management portal where we can share information, share data, connect, organize, etc. So it's a pretty important part of how we stay connected. A group of us from the Chicago PrEP Working Group pulled together and developed a white paper about a year ago, which we then turned into a concept note, and we called it Stepping Up the Pace Toward HIV Elimination in Chicago, Making Science Work. And what was interesting about this collaboration is a few people at this table and others, we included a major funder in the development of the concept notes. So someone who wasn't in HIV, who's been friendly to HIV, is actually the Alphawood Foundation that's based here. They funded a lot of our activities and other activities in Chicago, but we wanted them at the table to help us determine how to write this concept note so it would appeal to funders, and having a funder be part of it was an important part of the process, and it was new for me. I've never sat at a table and developed a concept note for funders with a funder at the table. And it ended up working out for us. They ended up giving us a $250,000 challenge grant. But I think we earned it, but it really helped that he was involved, that their team was involved. So we came up with this 3-prong approach to do HIV workforce trainings, to have centers of excellence, which is an idea, an evolution. I'll explain that in a social marketing media campaign, targeting 3 populations we think could most benefit from PrEP based on our data and based on where uptake is happening, or should say not happening. We're also working collaboratively to raise funds for citywide implementation of these activities. So the first thing, and we're AFC is leading this, but we partner with everyone at this table. We have a project called Ready, Set, PrEP, which we do workforce trainings. We've done them with a number of partners outside of the folks at this table, as you can see. They're about 4 hours long, and they involve varying players. We always have a PrEP user, people from different perspectives, and we've done these in Chicago, downstate, and suburbs. We share information also online on our Facebook page and our websites. So centers of excellence, our original idea was we're going to need to raise significant funding to help support clinics. We don't see centers of excellence that be standalone PrEP clinics, but increasing capacity for FQHCs and CBOs to deliver PrEP and to deliver it well. So we, you know, this like a year and a half ago, we thought, oh my God, we're going to have to raise $2 to $3 million a year. Pretty big, heavy lifts. It felt very daunting with everything else we have to do with the battles we're all facing. Many of you from Illinois know we don't have a budget yet at the state level, so we have a lot of things to fight. Well, the good news came in the fall, or earlier this year, the CDC released an RFP for PrEP-related provision of services, and our health department was successful in securing $3 million a year for the next 3 years. And much of that is going to go to PrEP provision. So it took a little bit of the heat off of us in terms of having to raise that money. We don't need to raise another $3 million, but we are continuing to raise money because we foresee gaps. We foresee them unable to fill everything we need to do, every geography, every population. There's going to be gaps, and so we're synergizing our work, and we'll be hopefully releasing our RFP with this outside money outside of the CDC. Will be released after we know the outcome of the health department's RFP for this funding. The health department's RFP has yet to come out, but we are hearing any day now, so hopefully that is true any day now. Right in time for Thanksgiving, but we're all ready to work on it. And I think I just want to highlight the importance of insurance and PrEP navigators. So there's a lot of work that people need to help manage the insurance and the varying access programs that Gilead has and the Patient Access Network Foundation has. These are really a critical piece of PrEP provision, and we may end up using some of our funds to support more PrEP navigators if necessary. Finally, the third prong I'm going to talk about is our citywide social marketing campaign. It's in development. We're planning to launch it in Q1 2016. We've been working on this a long time. I had originally said at the beginning of the year we would have something on the out in the market before the leaves fell. As you can see, leaves are falling. It's quite beautiful, and there's no social marketing campaign in the market. So we're still working on it, but we're going to be making some big decisions actually today after this meeting to get us moving forward. We have three key populations: young gay black men, black cisgender heterosexual women, and transgender women, and we intend to have distinct imagery and messaging for each group. We'll have placements in the social sphere, digital, transit, posters. We want to have a range, so we want to have messages that can work on our Chicago Transit Authority platforms and something that would work above a urinal in a bar or on a sex hookup app. So we need to have a range and have them be kind of and real in every space, that none of them feel diluted. They all feel authentic. And so that was part of our challenge, was finding something with range. We were very much edging towards the edgy side all the time. All of our, we've had a dozen different concepts that we've tried to bring forward, and we were always way too edgy. And you'll see why, because of where we're kind of coming at this from. But we've been lucky. We secured pro bono creative support and help with our strategy and placement through a collaboration of organizations out of Publicis. Publicis is a worldwide amalgamation of advertising agencies. And Egalite is their LGBT employee networking group. And through that, employees from Leo Burnett, Starcom, and Razorfish are helping us with this. So we're really blessed to have this. This is worth a lot of money, at least $500,000. And probably more when all is said and done. So we're getting a lot of support in how to figure this out. We're seeing community engagement being central. So the community are basically starring in this campaign, and we're hoping that they will be brand ambassadors. We're not hiring models. We'll be recruiting models from our community, and we'll be doing community events where we continue to generate new images for the campaign as the campaign rolls out. So the major attributes of this campaign is that it's sex positive. There's no fear, shame, worry in this campaign. We're focusing on the reasons why we have sex: love, lust, intimacy, pleasure, and the fact that PrEP can help us have the kind of sex we want to have without fear, anxiety, or shame, and particularly without HIV. We're planning to reclaim words like transmit, carry, and spread, which have negative connotations in terms of disease transmission, and we're marrying them with things like love and lust. So the idea of spread love. Spread love could be a safer version that we might put on the CTA. We might have carry paired with the word fuck, which would fit better above a urinal or on Grindr. We want it to be fun and shareworthy and viral. We have a URL. It's prepforlove.com, and we're using the hashtag prepforlove. And we'll be launching, it looks like Valentine's Day weekend, in February, so the love idea. And people will be pointed to our website where they'll learn more about PrEP and what PrEP actually entails. So here are, quickly, in my last couple minutes, lessons learned, and we can discuss more when we get to the end of the panel. The convening, coordinating, and collaborating of the working group has taken, in my mind, relatively little time. I've led a lot of coalitions like this, and I think we have so much passion and excitement, it hasn't been hard to get people interested and paying attention. We were able to pull from our 130 members a 30-member social marketing subcommittee to help develop these ideas as we move forward and help us plan for focus groups and help us plan for all the things that this campaign is going to take. So I really think, you know, if you build it, they will come. And it was a really good idea for us to do this. There was so much activity in Chicago happening, but we weren't all meeting at the same space and talking to each other. We didn't know what each other was doing. So just bringing people together in a regular time and saying we don't have to compete with each other, that the way to do PrEP well in this city is to all work together and to share information. If there's a new clinic coming on board, they shouldn't start with a blank piece of paper, that there's plenty of pieces of paper that have lots of information about how to run a PrEP clinic, and these folks can share it. So that's what we're trying to foster, and hopefully that will continue. It pays to collaborate, so we have the ability to share expertise, experiences, and perspectives, and mobilize and keep people engaged around these issues and bring people up to date on the latest in PrEP research. We think it's going to better serve our communities, and funders do like this. They like to hear that there is this collaboration, and there's a whole group of people working together, so they're not getting mixed messages from lots and lots of different people looking for PrEP funding. They have this idea that this has really been vetted, there's a lot of people on board, so it makes them feel a little more confident about how they might want to spend their funds so far. And in terms of social marketing, they've been, as I mentioned, the group has been really integrally involved in all the activities up to now, and because we're taking such a community-centered approach, and it's going to include events that roll out throughout the year, where people will be able to come, get their picture taken, get it kind of fun, prep for love-ized, with the words and the URL and the logo, and then they'll get copies of that and post that hopefully as their Facebook profile, etc. So there's a lot of work to be done, and we couldn't do it if we didn't have this working group pulled together. And finally, I'll just say, everything takes longer than you bargain for. Oh my God, I cut my hair recently, there was a lot more gray. I asked them to cut out all the gray and the whites. And so you just have to be flexible. One of my favorite things to think about is just being a willow. We're flexible, we bend, but we don't break. And with that said, thank you very much. And I'll turn it back over to our moderator.
Thank you, Jim. Next, I'm going to introduce Dr. John Schneider. He is an infectious disease specialist and the network epidemiologist at University of Chicago, Department of Medicine and Public Health. He is also the director for the Center for HIV Elimination there. Clinically, he specializes in HIV prevention and has a specific interest in providing high-quality care to younger black men who have sex with men and transgender women. Dr. Schneider, thanks.
Thanks, Tarek. Thanks, Jim. Other working group members helping put this together. So today I'm going to talk about race and the public health impact potential of PrEP in Chicago. I have no relationships to disclose. It's more and more evidence is kind of piling up that there's definitely a disparity in PrEP awareness, knowledge, linkage, you know, every step of the care continuum. This has been demonstrated. This has come to light because of several demonstration projects and other trials that have been run, which have been able to enroll large numbers of white patients, but a lot of the black patients have been left behind. And this has been a problem for most of HIV prevention, in that the things that we're studying in the populations that are not going to be the ultimate recipients. And so that's kind of been one of the axes we've been grinding. This is starting to change. There are several projects and randomized controlled trials that are starting to enroll larger numbers of African Americans, but frankly, we just really need to know how these new modalities, PrEP, other delivery options, how they work in African American populations. Some of the challenges with current demonstration projects have been the race definition. So there's, you know, there's been disparities also in biracial individuals, and so we know very little about that. Some people have talked about side effects as being a concern. There are also eligibility issues in how we think that someone might be eligible for PrEP as a PrEP provider. And then there's always the question is, do we get people in existing systems, so our internal referrals within our clinical systems, or do we get people outside of the system? We have a population-based cohort in the south side of Chicago called UConnect. We recruited 618 young black MSM. And this was done over 2013, 2014, just when the working group was getting going. And we only had 40% were aware of PrEP, and that means that they knew that PrEP was a medication that could prevent HIV. Things associated with that were having a primary care provider, so those were more likely to know about PrEP, participation in an HIV prevention program, having had an anal rectal STI test. And why that becomes important is because of disparities in engagement and care. And so if people are not getting anal rectal STI testing, they may know less about PrEP. And the membership in the houseball community is kind of an organic network that exists within this community. 3/4 were uninfected and 3.6% only had used PrEP ever, okay? And this is really the leading edge of the epidemic, and so this is the group that we need to have everybody aware of PrEP and also much more use if PrEP is going to have an impact on the epidemic. The CDC clinical practice guidelines are as follows. This is for PrEP use by MSM, so adult man without acute or established HIV infection. Any male sex partners in the past 6 months, not in a monogamous partnership with a recently tested HIV negative man, and at least one of the following. Okay, so these are other factors that the CDC has designated as being recommend that one use PrEP if they have these attributes. Now, you can see that again, I talked about any STI diagnosed report in the past 6 months. So if people are not getting tested for STIs, they may have STIs that are asymptomatic and not be diagnosed, and so they would not qualify. And so certainly when people come into my clinic, you know, we really dig into the details about what the risk is. But these are practice guidelines that are read by, you know, the providers that Jim and others are trying to change the hearts and minds of. And so this can be read very literally, and we could actually potentially be excluding people who don't fit this criteria. Here's the PrEP package insert. So this kind of broadens the eligibility. This is the Gilead package insert. So I've bolded, I'm obsessed with networks. I've bolded social network here, and basically any of these characteristics in the social network would make one eligible for PrEP. Now, this may go too far. You know, again, we also have this kind of balance that we want to strike where people who are lower risk or who may have one risk factor that is at times protected may not be eligible for PrEP. So that's another component that we have to think about. So what we did is we wanted to look in our cohort whether there's a network indication for PrEP. So we wanted to look at these two sort of guidelines for PrEP and see how it looked in our population. So again, this is a cohort study, so they come to us every 9 months, and and we ask them questions and test them for HIV and things like that. So these were the CDC recommendations, and these are our cohort at wave one and wave two. These are just the HIV negative people in the cohort. A third of our sample is HIV positive. And what we find here, if you want to just focus on the last line, using the CDC recommendations, only 44.7% of our sample was eligible for PrEP. Okay, so less than half. It increased at wave two, and we're trying to understand that a little more. It seemed like there was much more anal intercourse in the past 6 months at wave two for some reason. Usually it goes the other direction. People have less anal intercourse in these cohort studies. But regardless, about half of people were not eligible. And so if I'm a primary care provider who's not PrEP enlightened, and I'm looking at the CDC recommendations, and a young black MSM comes into my clinic, and I'm following these, half of the time I may say, well, you know what, I don't think you're eligible for PrEP, you know, according to the CDC guidelines. And so that's something that could be potentially problematic. When we looked at the Gilead package insert, these are all the criteria, and we found that 91% would have been eligible. So a much more liberal sort of eligibility, but certainly still there's 10% in a population that we might think 100% would be eligible, 90%. The other thing with this sort of eligibility criteria may be that people who don't have a very high risk network may have some of these factors. So, you know, we looked. You know, marijuana is currently considered illicit in Illinois. So we also looked at it excluding marijuana, and you can see the drop here. So a lot of people would be ineligible if marijuana is not considered illicit due to these guidelines. Importantly, and this is kind of the main slide, 13 of our clients seroconverted between wave one and wave two, 6.1% incidence, and we found that 61% were eligible for PrEP by CDC guidelines. So this really just hammers the point home that, you know, these guidelines may not be identifying the right people, and people who are the right people may be excluded in this context. 100% were eligible for PrEP by the Gilead package insert. That's all I have. Thank you. Oh, this is me? Oh, sorry. should have looked at these a little more closely.
How much time I got? 7 minutes.
7 minutes, okay. Okay. I was trying to rush through there. I'm going to touch on a couple projects that we have going on. These are two Chicago Department of Public Health SCD clinic collaborations. One of them is a project that developed organically with CDPH, where referrals of HIV-negative clients who are infected with syphilis, GC, or chlamydia come from two Southside STD clinics. And we link clients to PrEP care where they live, work, or play on the South Side. So essentially, anyone in sort of a partner services context or coming in for STD testing, we link to our network of PrEP clinics that we have on the South Side. Certainly, if they're on the South Side getting STD testing, but they live on the North Side or they're more comfortable on the West Side, we link to partners that we have over there. And then the second is a partner services PrEP project, this is a randomized controlled trial. This is funded by the NIH. And it's a linkage to care intervention. So, you know, we are really focused on the beginning of the care continuum in our group. So looking at awareness, knowledge, but then that really important insurance navigation and linkage to care. And so this is anyone in partner services, mostly MSM are part of this, are being going through a intervention with the interventionist to help them create a roadmap. How will they, you know, link in care? How will they retain in care? Things like that. This is our linkage cascade. So we have a PrEP line people can call. You can see a big drop off between total referred and then the successful initial contact. So even getting an active referral, there's 30 people who we weren't able to contact. We're able to schedule appointments, but then there's another big drop off to attending the first appointment. So you can see overall, all PrEP line referrals, only about a quarter actually make that first appointment. Okay, so this can increase, this green bar, if we increase this dramatically. So we need to really start driving referrals so we can increase the number of first appointments. In the CDPH referral, it's a little better. We have a more active referral of clients that have been in an STD clinic context, and we feel that they may be more activated to attend their first appointment, but still only a third. And then we're also training change agents to diffuse PrEP information and motivation. We have a Facebook network project. You can go visit our Facebook group. But basically, these are individuals who we bring in for a training, and then we train them on specifically on how to diffuse PrEP information to their peers within normal conversations. We have a lot of events and kind of contests and trying to really keep this group engaged. And it really, in my boring day of looking at emails, I get these really notices of people winning contests and doing different things on Facebook, so that's nice. Can I stop now, Jim?
No, you're done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we're going to keep questions till the end, and I'm going to continue with our third presenter. I'm so excited to introduce Dr. Sibel Hosek, who is the clinical psychologist and HIV researcher in the Department of Psychiatry at John Stroger Hospital, Cook County in Chicago. She has over 15 years of clinical and research experience working with HIV-infected and uninfected adolescents and young adults. Her research focuses on the development and implementation of HIV prevention interventions, including three youth-focused PrEP trials through the Adolescent Trials Network.
Thank you, Tarek. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate the organizers pulling us together here, and a little shift. I'm going to invite you into the process that we went through to establish a PrEP clinic in a public hospital system. And I have no relationships to disclose. So, I think just by way of background, obviously ensuring PrEP access to those who are most vulnerable to HIV really requires that PrEP provision be available in the absence of insurance, and to help those who are underinsured as well. And in that regard, public safety net hospitals may actually be one of the ideal places to offer such services for PrEP, although getting those services up and running may require some resilience. So, for background, for those of you in Chicago and those of you not in Chicago, this is the Stroger Hospital, which was formerly the Cook County Hospital. It's been around for more than a century, not in this building. This building was new in the early 2000s. The Stroger Hospital mission, the Cook County Hospital System's mission, is to provide services to the population of Cook County, regardless of ability to pay. And we have been really the safety net hospital of Chicago for over the last century. Affiliated with the Cook County Health and Hospital System and Stroger Hospital is the Ruth Rothstein Core Center. And the Core Center was really one of the first freestanding HIV-focused clinics. It was built in 1994, and it serves over 5,000 men, women, and children living with HIV. The Core Center really has a multidisciplinary medical home model, so we have integrated services, case management, substance abuse, pharmacy, social support, and we also have a really robust research side to the Core Center. And in fact, we started doing PrEP research at the Core Center in 2009. We started with one of the first PrEP studies for young people there, and really some of this push to open a PrEP clinic within our hospital is really being responsive to our research participants by having a place for them to go for clinical care for PrEP once they transition off of studies. And that's just really good clinical practice for research. So just to kind of give you a sense of the culture of the core, but also just I think of the county in general as a large bureaucratic system, but also of public safety net hospitals perhaps around the world or in this country, is, you know, for the Core Center, obviously most of our patients are living with HIV. That is what we were focused on. That is what we were designed to do. Most of those patients are uninsured, but they don't need insurance to come to the Core Center. We're not collecting co-pays. Really a lot of our funding was Ryan White funding and also county and public health dollars. We do, though, have a very large STI screening clinic, which offers walk-in services. So even though the perception in the community is that we are an HIV-only clinic, we do have a fair number of HIV-negative people who come to the Core Center and can walk in at any time for screening. Most of our clinics are, 8-4 clinics, or an 8-12 and a 1-4. Really, our clinics tend to be overbooked. We've always been, told assume a no-show rate of 50% and book those clinics in because we have such demand for services. And frankly, often the clinics are understaffed. And so while patients don't necessarily pay with dollars, they end up paying with their time. And that's not an ideal situation, but it's been something that's kind of become part of the culture of the county, is understanding that we're providing a service with no income, and unfortunately people may have to wait for that service. And then obviously medication availability is dictated by the formulary. So what happens then when you want to start a prep clinic within this cultural context? Well, there's this shift. And I'll tell you some of the particular areas where we've needed to shift and sort of how that's been accomplished. So, you know, here we are usually serving an underserved, uninsured, underinsured population. But all of a sudden we have these kind of early adopters of PrEP who are mostly insured, who are mostly employed, you know, working full time, not understanding why they have to come in for an appointment at 1 o'clock. When they really, you know, work until 5 and would like to come in the evenings. You know, there's also been this shift of seeing HIV negative patients in the clinic space of the core center, how to integrate them in our HIV positive clinics or to have them in a separate clinic, and really the feeling both of those negative patients as well as, you know, wanting to really protect and respect the rights to confidentiality of our HIV positive patients. The early adopters of PrEP that we have seen don't mirror our demographics of our typical patient population. And you see this when you walk into the PrEP clinic, and sometimes I think, where am I? Because this is not the population that we are used to serving. Again, largely insured, employed, and truthfully from a socioeconomic but also from a demographic perspective, much more Caucasian and much less African American and Latino than we are used to serving. So challenges that we faced even to get this clinic up and running, and you know, Jim talks about this year and a half time frame, and when the Chicago PrEP working group first started a year and a half ago, I think at the first meeting we said, we're opening our PrEP clinic. And at that time we had been working on it for at least 6 months, and we opened finally in April of this year. So it was well over a year and a half to get this clinic off the ground. Kind of bureaucratic, you think of, again, huge hospital systems and how to get things done. You know, 4 months at least it took just to get the template done for the electronic medical record. You know, because this is not, it was not a priority. It was one clinic. There are many other priorities to attend to. And so things like that just involve waiting and patience and waiting and more patience. Task sharing and task shifting. So we are an institution that is full of many collective bargaining units. You know, these are unions for nurses, unions for clerks, unions for lab techs, for, you know, for pretty much everybody that works at the hospital, where even our doctors are unionized. So you really have to negotiate tasks based on the parameters that collective bargaining unit has set up. So, you know, when I walked in and said, you know, could you please do this? And somebody said, I don't have time. And for me to say, that's fine, I have somebody else that can do that. No, you can't have somebody else do my job. This is my job, it's in my job description, and I will get to that when I can, and you're threatening my job, right, by having somebody else come in and do it. So what you want to do is to be collaborative and be helpful, but it's not always as simple as that. And from an administrative standpoint, you know, if I went to the administrator and said, we just need to do this, this, and this, and he would look at me like I was crazy, and I kind of am, and he, you know, Sybil, I have to talk with the lab management, the clerk management, the nursing manager, the reception staff. So there's lots of different steps along the way and lots of different people who have schedules that they have to maintain. They don't want to work overtime, or if they do work overtime, we have to pay them for overtime. So these are kinds of the things within this kind of system that you have to take into consideration. Again, we were used to having set clinic times. You know, we had morning clinics, we had afternoon clinics. But, you know, the lab closed at 4 o'clock, and that was the end. So how do we make clinic times that actually match up with patient preferred times? And the kind of, like I mentioned, the coordination between clerks and nurses and lab and pharmacy and benefit staff is difficult enough, but in this case, we're doing it around a new clinical service and largely a different patient population. So it's really a huge culture shift for everybody involved. That said, I think we've had many successes, and we are constantly improving, but we have enrolled over 200 patients to date in the last 6 months into our PrEP clinic, so I think that's really wonderful. We have providers who are so excited to provide this service. You know, they're interested, it's something new, they come to the clinic, they enjoy the patients, it's just doing something different, and everybody that's providing PrEP in our clinics is really excited about it. Having a dedicated nurse, a nurse practitioner as a clinic coordinator was really key because she really took over all of this responsibility of negotiating and making sure on any given clinic day that the lab was going to be open late, that the pharmacy knew that we were here, that the clerk was going to be available to register patients. And then also just having support for the idea of PrEP implementation within the institution and advocacy across sort of different departments and different groups, I think was really been critical and really one of our successes. So in our efforts to always get better, we did find providers who were willing to open up extra patient slots in their evening clinics. So that was wonderful, and so we're now able to provide PrEP in some of the evening clinics. And that did involve integrating PrEP patients into HIV clinics. And so we're still kind of, you know, standing back and waiting to see how well that goes. And we are continually working to expand our services to meet the demand. So for next steps, we're really, you know, our goal is, and I think it's the goal of everybody on this panel, is to provide PrEP to whoever needs it. In a timely and efficient manner. And so for us at the core, I think really our ultimate goal is the provision, daily provision of PrEP, that somebody should be able to come to the core center any day of the week and be able to see somebody and provide them with PrEP. We're not there yet, but that's definitely our goal. Jim mentioned, and I think Kristen will probably mention as well, the tremendous amount of resilience and effort it takes to go through the insurance process, to get into the medication assistance program, to work with some of the foundations to pay for these services, really requires focused and dedicated staff around benefits and case management. And so our goal really is to continue to improve on those services and bring in more staff around that, and then also really explore alternate payment methods and, you know, how can somebody potentially come into a screening clinic and, you know, and get STI testing or get STI testing at the local Department of Health, bring those results in so that they're not charged for those tests and be able to use those for their clinical care at a clinic setting. So those are kinds of the things that we're working on, and you know, really, as John said, the goal of all of this is to decrease health disparities. I mean, I think the nail in the coffin of PrEP would be if we continue to exacerbate the racial health disparities that already exist around HIV, and if we continue to bring those into prevention, then we're not doing the job that we set out to do. So, thank you very much.
So last but not least, I'm happy to present Kristen Kaglowitz-Breaker, did I say that right? Who is the Chief Operating Officer at Howard Brown Medical Center, which is the largest LGBTQ center in the Midwest, and delivers healthcare social services to over 16,000 people a year in Chicago. Her medical practice focuses on LGBTQ care, PEP and PrEP, transgender health, HIV medicine, health promotion. And her projects at Howard Brown include alternative insemination, primary care opt-out HIV testing, rapid Hep C, and the expansion of service lines to include pediatrics.
All right, thank you very much. So shifting, I'm going to talk a little bit today about PrEP implementation in a community health setting. So, and how we sort of did this at Howard Brown. So these are my disclosures. So Howard Brown Health Center, we just celebrated 40 years. We were founded in 1974. And as Tarek mentioned, we're one of the nation's largest LGBTQ organizations. Just to give you some demographics, we recently became an FQHC in October. We had been a lookalike for a long time, so we're sort of entering into that world. 31% of our patients are living with HIV, 44% patients of color, 46% fall below 200% of federal poverty, and we have mental health, primary care, STI, HIV walk-in services. We're in the northern community area of Uptown, which has highest HIV prevalence. And just sort of a map to show you where our locations are. And we're opening a new center in December that's also in the north side of Chicago. So I wanted to just mention our opt-out strategy because when PrEP sort of came, Howard Brown had been doing PrEP for a while prior in sort of a smaller way. And we really, a few of us sort of sat around the table and said, how are we going to implement PrEP here in a large way? And one of the strengths of our program at Howard Brown is we run a side-by-side sexual health walk-in clinic at the same time as primary care. So our providers are sort of supporting that nurse-run program. And we really had a program right when PrEP was starting where we decided that due to our data, we were doing a great job of testing patients in our sexual health walk-in because they were accessing and seeking that service. But when we looked at our data, we found that of the large number of primary care patients that were HIV negative, we weren't doing as good of a job as we could for screening for risk and doing testing. So we basically also had an issue, or a good issue to have, where we had a lot of medical assistants working in our community health practice that really were asking for more responsibility and they wanted to own a project. So we worked to sort of have our medical assistants really learn how to normalize HIV screening. We train them how to do that as part of vital signs, normalize the language. And I brought this slide in because I wanted to talk about how integral that was to what we did as well with our PrEP program, sort of getting it in all of our employees' knowledge base. So our call center, our front desk, our case managers, everyone knowing what PrEP was and sort of having that as part of their language. Sort of, again, everybody on board. So we talked a lot about it at staff meetings. We talked about it also as part of our opt-out. We made medical assistants as well as our linkage to care staff, case management, front desk call center understand that it was a high priority for Howard Brown to really implement PrEP. We wanted to move towards a model where people had low barrier to PrEP, as well as we run a pretty large PEP as well. So we get about, you know, 2 to 3 people a day that are coming in for PEP and sort of talking to patients as well as our staff about what does that mean, so that they don't just see the words PEP visit, that they actually understand medical assistance front desk, why people are accessing those services, so that they can buy into why it's important to sort of implement this program. So we looked at PrEP and PEP as sort of a continuum spoke in our wheel of prevention. So we sort of housed it in our prevention department when it first started. We really talked again about common language of staff. Training our call center and front desk was absolutely integral in the community health setting so that when patients called that they weren't necessarily having to transfer them to sort of discuss just basic knowledge about what they needed to know, send them to resources online as well as schedule them an appointment. We also implemented language for our nursing staff who runs our sexual health walk-in. We basically had integrated into our EMR that anyone who had who tests positive for rectal gonorrhea, chlamydia, or syphilis is having at least a conversation about PrEP. So it doesn't mean they're necessarily starting PrEP, but that that conversation is happening when we're making those phone calls or if they're symptomatic at visit. We really tried to talk a lot to the front desk and call center, and this isn't just with PrEP, but I think it was important for PrEP is to sort of be the yes people. So making sure that when patients asked about things, giving us feedback at leadership and clinical about what is the demand looking like and how do we sort of meet that demand so that we're not saying no, 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 and making sure that we're sort of saying yes. And that's what sort of brought us into having a designated PrEP, PEP, basically slots every single day that we have now ongoing. Making it as low barrier available as possible, we spoke a little bit about the biggest issue we started with was really the navigation around insurance and access. We had a lot of patients that were underinsured or uninsured, and we were working, you know, feverishly to enroll them in ACA, but had to access medication assistance programs, which patients couldn't necessarily navigate on their own, so that was also taking a lot of staff time in the beginning. And one of the things I always say is that although we're talking about PrEP today and the ultimate value for someone who's at risk, should, as John spoke about, should be on PrEP, is that what we found a lot in our community health setting was that value doesn't always lie in writing the prescription. So the conversations that we had about sexual health with patients brought in their partners, their friends, their community, and that even that patient that didn't walk out with PrEP in hand, there was still a lot of value in those conversations. So some of the things, just clarity key points we talked about, we got a lot of questions. I just talked about safety, so patients asking, you know, what does this look like long term for me? Is it safe? It is a pill. There's definitely nervousness around that. Resistance, so a lot of myths in the beginning, I think it's better now, but in the beginning a lot of questions about resistance and not understanding that if they're not HIV positive, that isn't, you know, going to happen. Adherence was a big thing, so our community is pretty savvy with social networks and different things where we're already getting those questions now, you know, can I take it less than every day? Can I take it on demand? And so a lot of questions about adherence in that way. Cost being huge, so the Affordable Care Act, for a health center like Howard Brown, the Affordable Care Act was huge for Howard Brown because we did not have a history and don't have a history of serving many moms and babies. We mostly have adults who did not have access to Medicaid programs before the ACA. So for us, it was not just navigating people around cost about PrEP, but also just the insurance that they signed up for. So people signing up for a Marketplace plan or a Medicaid managed care plan and not necessarily understanding what their health care needs when signing up for that plan and sort of being in the middle of it and then really realizing cost was a big issue. So we also worked, I had the luxury and the, you know, honor of working with Dr. McCarty, who's moderating today, and, you know, really just started to brainstorm about how, along with John and his programs, how do we work with the Chicago Department of Public Health, and they're doing so much testing but couldn't implement PrEP for various reasons of lab monitoring, et cetera. So in September 2014, we started to accept referrals from the Department of Public Health, and we really wanted that to look more than just a palm card being handed to a patient to say, call Howard Brown, because we know that that doesn't necessarily work very well. And so we had the highest number from Lakeview Specialty Clinic. CDPH did a great job of determining risk. And we tried out different contact methods, and then we worked back with the Department of Public Health to say, you know, this seems to be working, this seems to not be working. And out of that was really where we came up with the PrEP case management program that we implemented. So Brian Bautista has been our PrEP navigator for about a year and a half now. And we started to say there really needs to be case management around this, just as we have with Ryan White for patients living with HIV. So we've begun a PrEP case management program. We're demonstrating through a grant with the city to really look at not everyone needing case management, but for patients who do need adherence, counseling, navigation about benefits, and handholding. And we don't have any data on that, but preliminarily it's working well so far. So just for the subgroup of the CDPH PrEP initiator demographics, we had 27 initiators, 26 MSM, one heterosexual cis female. Average age was 27.5, 14 white, 3 black, 1 Asian, 1 other, and 8 Hispanic Latino. Indications overall, 7 of which rectal STI, 4 syphilis, 6 in serodiscordant relationships, 6 rectal STI and syphilis, 2 rectal STI and serodiscordant, and then or other. So this has been a big shift for our staff because I do want to talk a little bit about the case management. Our providers and medical staff were really used to having Brian and Matt, our two sort of PrEP team members right now, do a lot of paperwork pushing and a lot of insurance navigation. And when we shifted to this case management program, it's having other staff realize that we do want to use people at the top of their license. And so really shifting Matt and Brian into a role where they do carry a caseload, they do have the patients who are really high need, and moving the paperwork and the insurance navigation on to our sort of clerk staff and support staff has been huge. So that was an internal shift, though. In the first few months, we had constant communication of Brian and Matt about need, and we had to keep communicating back that we were really shifting to this case management program with them. Right now, where we're having official referral sources is coming from CDPH, BYC, and Chicago House. We also have a relationship with TPAN where we do data sharing agreement every month and sort of track those patients and let them know who came and who didn't. We did launch this in June 2015, and we sort of have 3 phases to this project. So to give you some data, again, it's very early, but I think it's interesting to look at, and it's already sort of molding the way that we're thinking about how to move this forward. For the patients that have enrolled, 23, average has been 30. This is the race, ethnicity, gender, and then where patients are coming from. Who has been sort of refused or lost to care has only been 3, so it's been successful so far of the referrals. And sort of race, ethnicity, gender, and then the sources. And the interesting part about this, if you talk to Brian and Matt, who do a lot of this work, a lot of the refused or lost to care, it's a lot of constant contact. So it's not, you know, necessarily, you know, saying okay at the first no. It's saying, you know, is it okay if I contact you in a few weeks again and see if it's something that might interest you? Or are there ways we can engage you in primary care at Howard Brown where there's no pressure to start PrEP, but can we at least be testing you on a routine basis and sort of keep implanting that seed? So that's been a lot of the work of the team that I work with. So some of the successes of that program is linkage to insurance for uninsured. So we have enrollment counselors at every one of our sites. And we really look at, as a community health center and an FQHC, we really look at PrEP as a clinician myself as a way to actually engage people in primary care. So I have a lot of patients who have come in for PrEP who have said, well, my provider said that they don't do PrEP. But I would say the vast majority don't have primary care. If we look at age and all of these presenters so far, these are patients who typically are mostly healthy, or at least think they're healthy, and they have other disparities that they need primary care for. So I've really looked at the value in being able to have conversations about primary care and sexual health as a result of their motivation coming in for PrEP. We also have been collaborating quite a bit with our partner services and PrEP teams. So we have disease intervention on site. We're lucky enough at Howard Brown to have our own disease intervention specialist in addition to the city, and that's been super helpful because we do partner notification for HIV and syphilis, and we've been able to also do a lot of conversation about PrEP as well. PrEP's been incorporated in our HIV and STI program, so every patient coming in for sexual health, our test counselors are talking to them about PrEP if they are at risk. We also run a testing together project that started off as a pilot from the CDC and have continued that project, and that's been a great way to talk about PrEP as well. And then just navigation through healthcare systems. I think PrEP has sort of expanded into talking about all the intricacies of navigating through that system. Our community advisory board has given, we had them work on a special project last year to give us a lot of input on PrEP. We have a trans drop-in that we run twice a month, and we have had education about PrEP. We've had PrEP initiations at that. And our biggest focus this coming year is going to be on trans women of color and young black MSM. And so that's something that we've been talking a lot about. We also run the Broadway Youth Center, which is sort of a social service with medical attached to it for young, unstably housed or homeless youth in Chicago, and have had a lot of PrEP conversations and initiations there as well. We've initiated 1,200 people on PrEP since 2012. We're working on retention data now to see how many are really active, but we've initiated quite a few. We have a big program. It's really reinvigorated our staff in the way that we discuss sex with patients. As Jim mentioned, I think doing this work for a long time, a lot of my patients, for instance, who I've been seeing for 9 years now at Howard Brown, for me it was an opportunity for me to really reinvigorate that way so that I don't sort of have that same conversation where they roll their eyes with me about condoms or about whatever I'm talking to them about. And so I've really had a lot of success with that. It's also reinvigorated the way we talk about behavior and prevention. And so I think, as Jim spoke a little bit about, really Howard Brown is a place that is sex positive, and we definitely have that mentality, but really encouraging people to sort of protect themselves and to discuss it has been huge. We also have a lot of people who will say, you know, can I bring in my partner or my friend at the next visit? And that's been a great way to even just have that sidebar conversation where they may not be a patient yet, just to do some education. It's been a big success. And then I said CDPH has been a great relationship to really learn some of the health department intricacies and have that referral as well as primary care engagement. Some of the challenges is we need more support staff. So insurance, paperwork, adherence. I think as a community health center, we've grown quite a bit in the last year in terms of patient volume. And what I'm learning is just, medical records, referrals. This is just one more thing added on the plate of paper. And so really pushing through, how do they push this through high priority so patients don't have barriers to PrEP or don't have cutoff in terms of interruptions in PrEP once they're initiated. Also, our challenges have been data collection on a larger scale. I always say hindsight's 20/20, but if I would have started this program, one thing I would have thought about was how we collect the data. One of the challenges we've had with PrEP, and it's getting better, but it's been a lot of working through, is because Truvada is also used for patients living with HIV and the way our system's set up, we've had some issues with discerning not necessarily PrEP and HIV, but PrEP and PEP, because of the way Truvada can also be used. And so we've had some issues with that, where we can exclude people with HIV on the problem list, but because of the volume of PEP, that's been a little hard sometimes. And then getting it in the right hands, as John spoke about, you know, one of the things that we've been proud of is that we think we've made a good headway in certain communities, but we have absolutely not made headway in some of the communities we serve. And so really going to learn with our community advisory board, as well as some other implementation project support, on how to really get this in the hands of people that need it most. Some of our challenges have also been race ethnicity data not always incorporated in referral docs. So as we worked on community partnerships, having to go back constantly and say, remember to put this data in, because we need that data, has been some administrative work. You know, transient populations with low resource. And then some self-reported trauma on other clinical sites. So how do we sort of have that when a patient has been told X, Y, Z, or we don't do this, or you don't need it? We have that happen quite a bit. Or actually some of that, as Jim spoke about slut shaming in the community, there is inadvertently some of that sex shaming or slut shaming that also goes on in the clinical world. So primary care providers or specialty providers sort of telling patients or looking at them sort of funny when they say they'd like to access PrEP. Has been something we've had reported by patients as well. That's Brian, my PrEP navigator, and I just wanted to, I asked him some of his observations, and, you know, he talks to people all day long on the phone, so sort of, you know, stigma, sex shaming, side effects, behavioral disinhibition, and then we talked about being denied PrEP. We've actually had very few insurance denials, so most of our navigation is prior auth, et cetera. At the end of the day, it's sort of the one who's willing to go the longest, right? So if you do the work and the paperwork, we've actually had very few denials. The issue is, do you have the resources to have someone? So, you know, I'm lucky enough to have an entire staff that's dedicated to prior auths, right? And so I realize that. But if you stop at the first no from the insurance company, you know, you will get some of those. But very few if you keep pushing and pressing. And that was just sort of our take home. And I just wanted to just show a screenshot of sort of what we use to capture in our EMR. So questions like, why do you want to take PrEP? How did you hear about it? What concerns do you have? Do you have any challenges that may interfere? And that's my email, and I thank you so much for listening. Thank you.
Thank you, Kristen. So now we can open for any questions. Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Mark. I work at the Laval Public Health Department in Quebec, Canada. I heard a lot today about primary care and hospital care, how PrEP can be integrated there. I was wondering if any experience could be addressed to anybody in the room, actually, of the role of public health nurses who do contact tracing, who contact the cases when STDs are first diagnosed, to incorporate PrEP into the messaging that they use over the phone, whether it's speaking to cases or contacts.
I can speak a little bit. We're not the public health department, but we do our own contacting at our grounds. We do our own wards and our own, and that is one of the things that was really important, was that we had a script that was literally under the standing order. So when you're calling someone who has recommended chlamydia or syphilis, you know, here's the sort of education we want to at least get out there. You know, here's our PrEP line. If you want to make an appointment, at least chat about it. You know, PrEP is, you know, this here's, you know, I can treat this, but know that, you know, you're risk for HIV, et cetera. So sort of some of that language. It's a little different because we're not public health in that way, but I don't know if it's fair.
So from my knowledge, this has been on the working agenda of the CDC to incorporate PrEP messaging in the DIS work. Washington State has been leading in this through their surveillance data for chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis. The DIS there have been working to give PrEP messaging to the patients, like contact them and tell them you've been positive for syphilis or rectal chlamydia, gonorrhea, and we recommend PrEP, and but there's still a lot of work being done to do it on the national level. Sure.
Just one other comment about that. The other piece is that this is a workforce. A lot of these people have been around for a while, and they've had to change. There's a lot of language that people are interacting. Particularly the more training and more cultural competency as well. Jim's program, RSC training, that trains the Department of Public Health staff and a lot of the CIS and public health services. But really, these are busy people, and a lot of times it's kind of the last thing that they end up talking about. And so in our kind of interactions, it's really moving out to be champions, so it's really hard work to get everyone up to a level, let's say, like a health and a PIS person.
Yeah.
And so, question, to get a little bit grander, I am former from St. Christopher's Hospital, but I'm from the VTI down there. We're actually launching our private initiatives just like a lot of the other programs within Philadelphia. But our issue is, among many, is generalized access to the general population. Like, obviously, the folks who get diagnosed immediately and those sorts of things. But how about just people in general? Like, you know about this preventative message. Is there any effort being made to kind of get that message out through social media? Or some type of CDC initiative that's kind of like just, blasting information about PrEP here?
So on the local level, I talked about, and maybe you weren't in at that point, I thought we were doing a social marketing campaign, and we're targeting young gay black men, trans women of color, and cisgender heterosexual black women, but it will be out in the public, so other people will see it, so we have a more generalized audience, although we want to make sure we're targeting the populations we think need it most, and we're not seeing them in uptake yet. There isn't a national effort yet. I don't think we're going to see that from the CDC, actually. Gilead, the maker of Truvada, has so far not commercialized how it sees Truvada as PrEP, so we're not seeing the campaigns you would see for HIV drugs or other products from the company. And that remains the same, although that could be a moving, I think things shift and change, but so far that's the case. So it has made it challenging. I think in the beginning, I say this a lot, if Gilead had come out with a PrEP campaign on July 13th, 2012, right after approval, they would have been excoriated. Our ears would all still be bleeding from the shrieking. But now, after a few years, many of us advocates who might have been shrieking on July 13th, 2012, wish or would hope that they could be involved in helping disseminate information. Their ability to do social marketing and market is much more than what little piddly pissant health departments can do. And I say that with love when I say pissant. It's much more challenging, and I think it wouldn't be in place of what we're doing. I think we would still want to have a citywide campaign here, but the more messages out there, the better. In our city, we still have all these different clinics that we've heard from have their own specialized marketing, pointing people to their sites, but sort of that general thing. Our campaign won't point to one site. Our campaign will point to a list of sites, and then you choose, or to information, and then you can then connect through there. But it is definitely a big issue, and we see that in Chicago and across the country.
You see, in Philadelphia, we have the health service kind of like taking on women's massive citywide initiative, and lists all of us, he talks about the practice, lists all of us who are available, and then different organizations like Philadelphia Fire out, just doing different presentations all over the place.
Yeah.
Can I take an annual question?
Sure.
So I'm
sure.
The ethics, and we obviously get the Truvada for our presentation over than that for sure. But we're finding struggle with folks who are under 18 who might not have the insurance, might not want to have their mom and dad's insurance, but are really at high risk and really should be receiving these resources. Any thoughts about how you can cover their labs and their medical account? You probably keep the medical account with the labs. You can't really hide that, and then obviously the Truvada. Any thoughts?
So this is a big issue, and I think, first of all, even though it's not contraindicated for adolescents, it's off-label, right? So that has insurance implications, although my understanding is for those
providers that I know that triage less than they have not been declined by Medicaid for those people.
Right. We have those who are uninsured.
Those who are uninsured or on their parents' insurance, you know, I think that they can access, well, depending on state law, in Illinois, at the age of 12, they can access STI testing and treatment services, you know, without their parents. So I think in any way that clinics can negotiate to use those services, those public health services that are freely available to them, you know, to supplement the clinical care that's being given to provide the PrEP, that would be great. But I think the drug cost is still going to show up on that parent's insurance because the medication assistance program, which is run by Gilead, is not going to provide medication to somebody off-label. So it's a really complicated issue, and we're hoping that we'll have data. There are two studies that are specifically focused on adolescents, and that data should be coming out early next year, you know, over the summer. So we're really hoping that the FDA will consider lowering the age to make, you know, an approved product for people under the age of 18.
And I just like to jump in on the issue of, so it was great when the ACA allowed young people to stay on their parents' insurance to 26, like, yay, something we fought for. There has been some unintended consequences. So the 20-something who wants to get on PrEP but doesn't want their parents to know. Mm-hmm. And there's really no way to do it. Even if it was masked from the bill, you're going to see something happening with your deductible and charges happening, even if it's masked out. And so we've, advocates across the country have been working with Gilead to see if we can set up a waiver kind of program. So while the Gilead's medication assistance program is seen as a payer of last resort, and if you're insured, you don't have access to that. But in cases where if someone can make a, you know, a legitimate documented claim that this would create harm in my family, if my parents knew, my parents don't know I'm gay, my parents don't know I'm sexually active, this is not something I want to broach with them, it would not be a good scene. If that could be somehow documented, get a waiver so we could actually have them access the medication assistance program, even though they're technically not able to because of the insurance. And that is a discussion that's in progress.
This discussion hasn't been done yet, case by case.
It's a discussion in progress. Most cases that have been brought forward have not been successful.
But keep trying.
Well, and I think Kristen's point of keep trying. If you give up, that's you give up.
So yeah, with the PDF and that, like, I always tell the our pharmacists and our navigators, like, I get it, like, you're both kind of denied, you just want to go to the alternate, but we have to show need. And so we, you know, continue to send in the 20-year-old. Not a parent's insurance, we send it in, and then we send it into Gilead, and Gilead says no, you can't because they're insured. But it's that process of, you know, they have this need to make change, and I think that, I don't know if it'll come to fruition, but it's better than them saying, you know, the data shows us we didn't have this need, nothing for men. So.
And I will say, while we haven't seen the change that we are requesting, we have had open channels of discussion. We've discussed this with leadership at Gilead. A number of advocates have met with them in person and via phone. And then there's these efforts coming from clinics documenting need. So I think it's something that we're keeping our eye on and we're not letting go.
Something we can in some ways work together to like add these pressures.
Yes.
Philly,
Chicago, yes. And actually Philly is one of the great places that is adding a lot of pressure. So Philly fights,
yes.
Philadelphia fight. They're fighting, baby. Yeah.
Yes?
I have a comment and question, and Sarah Feld, who is the for public health. I commented in response to your question before. I just wanted to mention that in Connecticut, what we're doing is having the CIS folks notify when they're calling and contacting people who have had unreported STI, they're notifying them that they'll be hearing from a PrEP navigator, mm-hmm. and then there's a PrEP navigator. My question, first of all, I love what you're doing in terms of the social marketing campaign, in terms of being very sex positive and sort of reclaiming some historically loaded terms. You mentioned there being priority populations. I think sometimes it can be a bit of a delicate balance in terms of ensuring that messaging is salient to the priority population without being stigmatizing. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about how you're involved
That is a great question. So they are going to be integral. We're going to have community members in the campaign, actual people from Chicago who are not models, and we're going to be involving in on that. We've had a group in our social marketing kind of subcommittee from the Chicago Prep Working Group. We had representation from the population, so it's been helping us through this very long, arduous, but creative journey to figure out how do we get to where we are. And we're just about, actually today, we're sort of signing, sealing, and hopefully beginning to deliver our research component before we launch. So we are going to be doing some types of focus groups with the three populations to make sure we're not missing the mark, that we're not doing anything inadvertently problematic. We have put a lot of thought into this, but we could be missing something. So we are going to be doing focus groups very, very soon, breathtakingly soon. with our populations, and then it will be an ongoing thing. And I think what the value here is that people who join the campaign, so we'll have an initial blast of the campaign out there, and you mentioned sort of being delicate. We don't want to have anyone feel like they're in the crosshairs of a target. So their priority populations are not targeted. Targeting sounds very violent. And it's also like, who wants to be the target? Who wants to be pointed out as, you're at risk, you're bad. So there will be images in the campaign that are broader. So we may have, they will all feature couples. And so we will have couples, for instance, who may be interracial. We do want to make sure that we have, and we will be placing ads in places where there's high incidence, but there will be also ads kind of in the broader market. So it's not, again, like, okay, we're just targeting this neighborhood on the south side or west side or north side where HIV is known. So we're being very careful about how we roll it out. And then finally, I think when people, after our first wave, when people come to our events, they can become part of the campaign, have their picture taken. They'll choose the words that they want emblazoned on their thing. They'll get a copy of that. So we're hoping that if people, because no matter what you do, people say, I don't see myself in the campaign. So you know what? Come to our event in March. And you can have your picture taken and you can be in the campaign. You'll be in the campaign. Your picture can go online. We'll give you a picture. We'll give you a hard copy that you can hang up in your home or your office. And we hope that that ongoing engagement will make sure that it stays culturally, you know, empathetic and relevant, and also point us to things that if there's anything that's sort of going wrong. We know it's going to be a little edgy. I think showing people in loving embraces and kissing and nuzzling as gay couples or transgender couples in certain neighborhoods is going to be quite, it's going to be something that no one's ever seen before. So we are preparing for that, and I'll finish by saying we will have, for all of our members in the working group and for community organizations who are in these communities, we're going to have talking points, FAQs. So if there is someone like clutching their pearls, oh my God, I just saw there's two gay men kissing on our CTA stop, our transit stop, and it says spread love, and this is horrible. How dare gay men spread love? And we're expecting that there'll be some of that. We will have people prepared, so they'll kind of know, they'll be able to understand the campaign, they'll be able to explain the campaign, and they'll be able to hopefully stand up for the campaign. And then have some basic talking points so they're not caught off guard. A lot of us working in prep, we're faced with tough questions every single day, and we're used to answering every tough question, but if you haven't really thought about it much or don't need to think about it 24/7, it can really catch you off guard if someone who's an ally gets in your face and starts shaking your finger about promoting sex. You know, as if sex ever needed promotion. But we will see that. So we are trying to be thoughtful and have, by the time we launch on Valentine's weekend, people will be ready.
Have you in terms of your social campaign, have you thought about using applications like Scruff or Grindr to get not just little banners, but actually getting people to put it in their own profiles, saying that you're on prep, write it in your profile. I know that some cities, even without any necessarily any structured way, a lot of people are saying that they're on prep and out about it. And I think it just sort of sets that social norm and you get people talking about it and they ask questions about it. So, but if you have any ideas about that, that'd be great.
Well, it's definitely happening. Scruff has already built it into their formatting.
Mm-hmm.
People are putting it in their description and their information and even in their screen name on Grindr and other applications that may not have exactly the box to check at this point. And we are creating, the campaign will be featured on sex hookup apps, so we will be there in that space. And it's a great idea to encourage the people who use those apps. If it will be couples who have their picture taken. Not everyone on Grindr wants to say that they're in a couple, but if they're into that, they're looking for playmates. I think it's a great idea to encourage them to use that. We want people to use the photos that they have taken of themselves and all their social media. We hope they'll put it on Instagram and Facebook, on sex apps or wherever. To help get the word out and to sort of build off of the great work that John's doing, creating these ambassadors. We have more and more people kind of standing up for PrEP, talking about PrEP, normalizing it across all kinds of platforms. But I think it's a great idea to encourage people to use pictures with their hookups or honeys on because I should be clear, the couple of pictures we're taking are just, we're not doing a test so you have to be in a couple for X amount of time. This could be a new love, an old love, it could be a hope for love, it could be a love that just, we're love in many different forms. Love for the moment, love for for eternity. Or somewhere in between. Mostly in between.
Has there been a demand for on-demand prep? And if there has, what has been your response?
Sure. Yes, I think people are picking up on it. We've taken a stance at Harbrown, where our conversation that we sort of talked to providers who brought this up to us, and what we say if someone says, I heard there are some studies about this, this are my times of I heard this coming days I need to be protected, et cetera, et cetera. So, our conversation with those patients has been it is being studied. There is data. And right now our stance is that our indication is you should be taking it every day. Now those conversations that happen one-on-one with me and a patient might be different, right? So if I have a patient who says, I'm not gonna take it every day, I'm not gonna say I'm removing you off of PrEP, right? So I'm gonna encourage them to use it the way that at this point we know works best, but I'm also gonna negotiate with them just like I would run anything else. So I think it's sort of I know I'm not answering it completely clear. I guess what I'm trying to say is that an organization is sort of taking the stance that we should be encouraging and educating about what on-demand prep is and where that might go, but those conversations will happen one-on-one. I can say myself, I have absolutely have patients who, even though I educated and taught, they're doing it on demand, and they know the risk they may be taking, you don't know. But that's been definitely a conversation. It hasn't been a promotion necessarily. I don't know if that helps, but.
We have conversations around how to present to patients, and we would do exactly the same as Kristen. We haven't had a lot of patients asking about it.
Yeah, we think the same. A lot of our patients haven't read the literature and don't know about the studies, but what I think I do a little more of, so I take care of both positive and negative, is so first of all, I treat it more like condoms, so it should be taken all the time, but we know that people slip up or aren't able to, so you just have to do it as much as you can, and giving them, if the conversation goes there, really at least four days a week would be the private conversation. I do think that, there is, particularly guys who are in service work relationships, there is this kind of, much more kind of hands-on, kind of big brother, you have to take medicine every day, there's resistance and your health and things like that. And so I think really trying to soften that message with the negative guys and make it that it's clearly important, but ending the pill here and there is not something you can do. We have to be realistic, and I think that's we know people are
I found too, to piggyback on that, it's often how you ask the question. So sometimes I'll say to a patient, I find often with my patients that they miss doses here and there because life gets in the way. And then I'll say, is that something that happens? And most of the time it's too, yeah, I do have it. Where instead if I say, you're taking your meds every day, people may read, they don't know if I'm reading, they're reading it off of me that I'm going to be upset or going to be, because I think, you know, we do this with all things, right? Like what happens in between visits, you know, we survey patients at a moment in time. And so I also talk to them about, you know, the 3 weeks when you have to visit with me, I know you're going to be thinking about the fact that you just made the appointment, you might have better appearance. What are we going to do about like 3 months in between, you know? And then they send me ammo prep. Mm-hmm. So I really phrase it from a real normalization. Like, I find a lot of patients are in the same boat here and there. What's that looking like for you? You know, just that, and then you'll get that story back a lot, where, yeah, I really didn't see more than I should. Or, and then I'll say, you know, some of my patients, I'll say, when that happens, and then I'll really have that conversation about when that happens, we'll talk about what confidence that looks like, and so we'll perfect it again. Or, you know, so that they can build the tools when that happens again.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is really, at least for me, really training to, My social sexual history is like the biggest part of my, you know, note, because you know, everyone has a different typology, and so maybe people have you know, that one sex party that, you know, certain times are more risky than others. So we emphasize also maybe really need to make sure that when you have an spoken up and making sure that you're taking in all the time and things like that, kind of test prep.
Question there?
Yeah. Wonderful presentation. As a person with cancer, how much additional time is required to integrate that discussion and prescription about PrEP into a general primary care visit?
So, a lot of the how does PrEP come into, you know, quote, cancer, you know, across the country? I think that's the biggest struggle. I mean, we're part of an implementation project that the certain clinics that are more specialty driven stuff, work with the population mostly with HIV. And then there's, like, you know, Philly's one of those sites, and we have these kind of departments of public health sort of clinics. And then I work with a lot of FQHCs, and that is the biggest struggle, is to get get into the workflow of not only are the providers able to talk about sex with their patients, you know, sort of the biggest hurdle, but then also, you know, as part of a regular primary care visit, does sex even come up in, you know, regular history, physical? And on top of that, if it does, do you have time with all the other competing needs to do something that's both optional? It's the Viagra, you know, it's something that is, you know, sexual health is really, you know, minimized by a lot of the, you know, the cholesterol screening, are you up to date with colonoscopy, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So our numbers reflect that. Our numbers of people who have successfully been internally referred within an FQHC context that's not specialized in FQHC, it's really hard going. I think the jury is still out whether it would be, you know, something that can happen on a larger scale. Kind of a little down, but I mean, it's just what we're seeing. We're just not seeing as much, you know, as much as we could have.
To kind of on the other end of the spectrum, our service is set up more as a specialty service. Where primary care is elsewhere, but what we find with a lot of our patients is that they really aren't accessing primary care. So a lot of that actually starts to bleed into the specialty visits instead. And so, you know, for example, we have, you know, our new patient prep appointments are, you know, 20 minutes, and our, you know, our follow-ups are 15 minutes, and inevitably, you know, it doesn't ever get done in that time because all these other things begin to bleed into the specialty care. So, you know, I think we haven't found that balance yet.
Can I add something? So one of the things that they see for the health care system, and it's been a number of years, and it's really difficult. And we are required to go to the protection of the brain and help them discuss sexual education. And this is really uncomfortable. And the same pediatrician would be, you know, the same kid that they're taking their sexual life.
All right, well, thank you all for coming this morning, and these are the contact emails for the presenters.
Thank you
for coming.